You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers out there. I'm back here in the studio of Gangland Wire. I've got my good friend and a guy who was immense help to me making my Brothers Against Brothers movie recently, Casey McBride. Welcome, Casey.
Hey, thanks for having me. I finally made it to Gangland
Wire.
Finally
made it. You know, Casey and I go back to my earliest days with doing this mob stuff all the way back to... Went out to Las Vegas to the Clark County Library and did a mob program about using my movie or my book, one of the two, or maybe a little bit of both, about the skimming from Las Vegas. So Casey lives in Portland, and he came down. And then was that when we met, what's our friend's name from Pahrump?
Bill Friedman.
I think he came down that day, too.
He did,
so it's nice to, you know, you work with these people and you see people over the internet and you never meet them in person. And Casey was kind enough to come down and we met up and met Bill and kind of formed a relationship, and we've continued to maintain that relationship and this business, if you will, or hobby, I don't know which. I haven't made any real money out of it yet, but I run it like a business. Of documenting a mob history and entertaining and enlightening the general public about the mafia in the United States. And it's a fantastic subject, don't you think, Casey?
Oh yeah, I got hooked on it. If you would have told me 10-11 years ago I'd be doing this, I would have thought you were crazy. But once you kind of get the bug, you see it a lot with the folks on the groups and things like that. Once you dive down that rabbit hole, it's hard to come back up.
Well, speaking of the groups, you're real active on the different Facebook groups. So tell the folks a little bit about what face groups are out there and that you're real active in.
Well, the most active that I'm on Facebook right now is with Uncle Frank's Place, and that's a Facebook page I started that's just dedicated to the history of Frank Costello. And started that as just a hobby, kind of like we're talking about. Kind of took off, got quite a few people on there nowadays. And I also contribute once in a while to the nationalcrimesyndicate.com, which you do as well. And every once in a while I'll write a bit for them and put stuff up. And those are kind of my two main ones. I also have one other group that is not quite as active, but on Joe Petrosino, called Petrosino Square. So I try to use that one to post stories that I come across on mob cops. Yeah. And, the other side of the story, which, as you know, I'm pretty fascinated in that, too. I think that's just as interesting as the bad guy's side. Right.
And for folks that don't know who Joe Petrosino was, I tell them just a little bit about Joe Petrosino. I did a show. You can go back and listen to my show about Joe, but tell them a little bit about Joe Petrosino.
Well, he was kind of, in a way, probably what I would consider one of the first real mob cops. He was the first Italian that was ever in the NYPD. He was too short to get into the NYPD at the time, because I think he was only 5'2". But they basically gave him a waiver, and they let him in, which was a good decision, as it turns out, because he was where most of the cops of that day were Irish. They had a real hard time, catching black handers and stuff like that. They just didn't know their customs and their ways. They're easy to spot, an Irish cop. And since he could speak Italian and kind of knew that world, he became pretty successful in busting a whole lot of bad guys.
It cost him his life in the end, though, didn't it?
It did, yeah. He was, sadly, he was gunned down in Palermo, Italy. He was on an assignment over there. And I think that still to this day, he's the only officer of the NYPD that was ever killed in an assignment overseas.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, I don't even know how many guys go overseas these days to do assignments.
They do. There is a few today, because they got this big joint task force on terrorism. And they act like federal agents, and they can be shipped overseas and do things like that. Even in Kansas City after 9/11, all of our intelligence guys, all of a sudden, except for a couple, were shifted to the Joint Task Force on Terrorism for a while. I think it's probably backed off a little bit now. But, I asked them about that, and they said, you wouldn't believe the amount of tips that come in that, we have to go check out. So, I don't know.
I bet, yeah, yeah. It used to be an apartment manager in another day, but this was right after 9/11, and we were constantly, we had FBI guys that were actually had an apartment in my complex because they were always watching these guys, you know. And they busted one. One guy who was running guns from Korea. Really? And he was one of my tenants. And then one day he didn't pay his rent. And I found out in the newspaper the next day they'd come and got him. And he was put in prison. So it was.
Well, Casey, speaking as a guy who's done that, thank God for you friendly apartment managers who will help us out doing that kind of thing. And keep your mouth shut, right? Too, because I've been burned a couple of times, too. But usually we'd go in, if we'd go in a neighborhood, we'd go in under a complete cover. We tell a manager that we were a surveying crew that was in town and we needed a place to store our equipment, and a few guys would come in town for a few days and stay overnight and leave again, so we wouldn't keep regular hours, and that was a cover story that worked pretty well.
Yeah, it's there's some pretty good stories about Gotti, about the FBI trying to rent an apartment across the street from him and set up all these things, but people on that block would suss those people out
and
tell them on them, and they had the whole neighborhood against them. Yeah. So it's not just the mob guys you're going after; it's all the other people in that whole community. So
okay,
but other than that, I also have a website. It's frankcostellohistory.com, which is. It's still pretty new. It needs a lot of updates, but I just kind of add stuff as I come across things and when I can. So it's, hopefully in a couple of years, it'll be a big old database on just the history of Frank Costello, but also like all the books that are out there, a place that you can go if you want to know, what book is good on him. I try to do little reviews on the ones I've read and that kind of stuff.
Good
but,
idea.
That's pretty much, what I do. Aside from that, I do music, and I've been contributing to Gangland Wire, some of the music,
which
I really like doing. That's a lot of fun.
Little clips, like my opening and closing clips are yours. I've used some other of your little clips. Casey would send me little short snippets to, sometimes I'll break up a segment, or there'll be like a natural turning point. I haven't done that for a while, but. So he sent me one that kind of sounded like him with the Godfather theme, So I don't have to pay royalties on that. We don't have to worry about the Godfather,
right?
Francis Ford Coppola or whatever his name is, or Mario Puzo. They didn't compose the music, but somebody sued me for that. And yet we had Peter Gunn, which I love that Peter Gunn one.
Thanks.
Kind of a jazzy kind of a thing. What was it? James Bond, I think. That was a good one, too.
Yeah. I think the first one, I remember I was listening to your podcast, and you had mentioned you would like to come across some music that sounded sort of like the Untouchables,
Untouchables,
so I got to thinking. And I was like, I wonder if I can make something like that up. And it came out, I sent it to you, and then I heard it on the podcast.
Yeah,
I was like, all right.
I used those a year or so ago. I used those a lot more, and somehow I've got out of the habit. You're just getting these patterns, and I don't use them so much. But more importantly, Casey, I really appreciate it, and I want people to know what you did. And when you're listening or when you're watching my movie, Brothers Against Brothers, how would you describe that sound? He did three different songs. I sent him songs that I used to, that were used in something called Spooks, which is a British spy series, or MI5 is the American name on it. And I love that music for music to build tension drama. And so I don't know what you'd call that, but he gave me three different pieces, and I used them all the way through. I love that music, Casey.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it was a lot of fun to do. When you sent me those clips, it's nice to get an idea of, like, this is what I'm looking for. And that kind of music is it's pretty easy to do these days at home, in your home studio. You don't need to record an orchestra or a horn section or something like that. It's kind of more electronic sounding. So it's a lot of fun to do because you don't have to write a chorus or words and verses. You can just make soundscapes to, fit something. And then when you hear it, behind the scenes that you did, it's great. It's a real thrill to see.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Matter of fact, folks, I'm going to throw in a clip right after this. When I edit this thing, you'll hear a little clip of one of them, so you kind of know what I'm talking about. And I'll kind of leave it going right underneath the scenes, underneath our talking a little bit. Anyhow, moving right along, let's get. I know mob fans like horse, but like for me, anyhow, for the podcast to get right to the subject. So we probably bullshitted long enough. I shouldn't say that. We probably talked long enough about a variety of different things. Let's get to the subject of Frank Costello. And we were talking earlier, Casey, and you suggested. There's a lot, you know, there's a whole life history of Frank Costello. I told the story of Frank Costello the time he left $30,000 on the in a taxi cab?
Yeah, I think it was $25,000.
Taxi cab. The taxi cab driver turned it in. He gave him a reward when he got it back, but then he didn't get it back for a long time because he turned it into the New York City police, and when they figured out whose it was, they hung on to it. He had to go to court to get it back, which I can see that. I'd have done the same thing, but been here in Kansas City, been in charge of the property room, I'd said, no, we're not going to give that back to you.
Right. How'd you get it? His story about how he lost it is pretty funny, too, or how, you know, he said that he mixed that envelope up with a gift that he was given a friend, and you know, it's obvious, you know, it's just an excuse. Yeah. But
that was 1950 or kinda, something. You have $25,000 in an envelope, or maybe even 40.
Yeah, I think it was actually even 40s. In the 40s, because that was really one of the first times that he came up in the news.
Oh, really?
He was actually, it's kind of hard to believe now when you see all the photos and all the stories about him, but for a long time, he was really under the radar, and a lot of that had to do with the fact that he just changed his name to Costello. Yeah. His original name was Castilia, and you know, he kind of got an Irish version of it, and he didn't really hang out with a lot of like other mobsters. He was kind of always had his he was always part of the, you know, what we call the Luciano or Genovese family, Genovese, and but he always had his own kind of things going, his own businesses, his own slot machine, things like that. So he didn't run around with a lot of other mob guys like some of them do, where they all, you know, that's the only kind of people they hang out with. He was hanging out with more high society people in a way, but so he was kind of under the radar for a while until that. And then he started popping up in the news quite a bit after that. That's when his life kind of took a, you know, more of a turn. Yeah. But
so there's a lot to talk about Frank Costello, and we're not going to go over all of it. We're going to go to the part of his life really when he was kind of in retirement, or he was a professor emeritus, if you will, of the mob later on. And there's a movie out there. It's a series, actually, isn't it? Called The Godfather of Harlem. And Frank Matthews is, or Bumpy, remind me.
Bumpy Johnson.
Bumpy Johnson
is kind of the main character.
He was a numbers runner, had a numbers kingpin in Harlem, and numbers was a huge racket in Harlem, which the Italians eventually, in every major city, it starts out in the black community with the black godfather, but every major city, the Italians see that money coming in, and they want a piece of it, and they'll end up, if they don't just capitulate, why, they'll knock them off or whatever. So this is that's what this series is about. But this, tell us about Frank Costello and his life during that time and what his piece of that was.
Yeah, well, the series, first of all, it uses real characters. It has Frank Costello. It's got Bumpy Johnson, The Chin, and Joe Bonanno, or they're pretty strongly featured in this show, but it's a fictional show completely. You know, and they're not trying to say that it's history. They're just using these real characters to make a completely fictional series. And I enjoy it. A lot of people hate it. they don't like the idea that it's not real history. And I can kind of understand, because it does confuse a lot of people. I've been getting emails from people actually all over the world. It's pretty amazing, and they're asking me questions about the show. Really? Like, well, did Frank Costello really know Bumpy Johnson and all these things? And I was, you know,
did he?
I can't tell you. As far as I know, he didn't. Now, they might have crossed paths, especially in the early days, maybe in Harlem back in the day. You know, Frank, he ran with it. Like I said, he ran with a lot a way different crowd than a lot of the mobsters did. You know, he was living in a penthouse on Central Park West. You know, even after he retired in 57 and he was no longer, you know, technically the boss, his life really didn't change much. He still had a really nice house out in Sands Point. The guy who helps me out with my my website and the Facebook page, Mike Mafucci, who anybody who's in these groups knows who he is, he was lucky enough. He went out to Sands Point and got to meet the lady who lives in his house, and she let him walk around the grounds, and he filmed it, and that's up on our website if you want to kind of see what his house looks like today. And she knew all about him. She was willing to talk about it and everything. So it was kind of surprising that, you know, she would let him do that. But so when he retired in this television show, it takes place right around, I think, 63, when Bumpy Johnson supposedly got out of, I think, Lewiston Prison is where they say he was. And according to the movie, he saved Frank Costello's life in prison. And so they're friends, and they kind of have a... They kind of have each other's back for most of this series, but as far as I know, they never met each other in prison. I don't think they ever served together. Frank was in Atlanta Penitentiary, and he did some time in Rikers Island, but I don't think he ever spent any time with Bumpy. I think that that section of it comes from, there's stories that Luciano and Bumpy served time together, and there's one rumor out there that Bumpy saved him in jail one time and they became friends. So I think that's what that's based off of. But, I don't think Frank would be seen back in those days. You know, how to put it, right. But, you know, he was a man of a product of those times. You know, he was a rich white guy. I don't, you know, he probably wasn't going to be going down to Harlem and hanging out with, you know, guys who were, you know, suspected or known to be selling drugs, heroin and stuff like that.
Because he was not dealing drugs. That was never his thing.
Well, yeah,
he was 100% gambling, wasn't it?
He was gambling, and you know, he started with the bootlegging. Well, he was probably about the second biggest bootlegger probably on the East Coast. And then, you know, he transitioned. He was one of those guys who was smart enough to see the writing on the wall, and they transitioned into slot machines with Meyer Lansky and all those guys. But In this show, they feature him quite a bit, like being involved with the heroin trade, not doing it himself, but at least being in on meetings, talking about it. You know, I certainly think that in reality, he knew what was going on. I can't imagine that somebody that is as street smart as a guy like that, the way he came up and being a bootlegger smuggler himself, you know, he knew that was going on. And I'm sure he got profits from it too, but I don't think that he ever personally himself was, you know, involved in the selling of it or had his own guys out there doing it. In fact, there's a pretty good FBI document that's out there. You can see on my Facebook, where he wanted, I think it was Mike Coppola hit, at one time. There was in a commission meeting, and Frank was trying to get approval to have this guy hit because he was selling drugs around some of his clubs and doing that kind of stuff in his, you know, in his casinos and stuff like that. He didn't really want that kind of stuff around. But they didn't approve it. He didn't get his way. And so, see, that's a good example. There's just too much money in it, you know. And I think he was the kind of guy, the way he saw himself, like I say, sort of apart from your everyday mobster thug. I think he would probably think that dealing with that kind of stuff, that's below him, you know, he wouldn't want to be associated with that. But that being said, his guy, you know, the guys in the mob were definitely doing it when he was boss, and, you know, so we all know that.
If you're the boss, you're going to get a piece of the action.
They're
way down the down low, and they really were back in those days, not until 1957, and after that, did they ever try to keep it on the down low.
You know? So, as far as I know, I've never heard a story of him turning down an envelope with money in it, you know, and I'm sure he had to know where some of that was coming from. And, you know, a lot of guys, depending on how you look at it, maybe indirectly, he was kind of responsible for a lot of those guys getting into it. Because at the time he became the boss, he really, I think, felt that he was just kind of a stand-in for Lucky Luciano. You know, he was just there to kind of run things for him. I don't think he really ever saw himself as taking, like, I am the boss now. You know, he knew he was there to kind of just run things while Lucky was gone. And the way he did it was he kind of let people do what they wanted. He wasn't one of those guys that ruled everything with an iron fist, had his nose in everybody's business. You know, as long as things were running smooth and there were no problems, he let people kind of do their own thing. And a lot of those guys, because of that, you know, Costello was really good at making money. That was what he was good at. And I don't think he had – it was hard for a guy like that to understand that for some other people it's not as easy to make money like that. They weren't as successful as he was. And a lot of those guys were suffering kind of economically because he didn't really oversee that, you know, personally. He just let them handle their own business. And not all of them were successful. So I think – you know, they turned to drugs because they wanted to get money. They weren't getting money. It wasn't trickling down to them the way they wanted it to.
That was a huge transition from bootlegging to what? What do I do now? There's no money to be made bootlegging. Well, I got a bunch of clubs out here maybe I control, but there's not that much money in that. And then that's when they transitioned to gambling primarily, but drugs would be the other thing that would be really like bootlegging. You know, you got to smuggle it in and clandestinely sell it. And so there's a lot of parallels, and I can see where a lot of them would move into that.
Yeah, I would imagine too, because, you know, Frank was one of the guys that really opened up a lot of the smuggling, you know, passageways on the East Coast up from Canada. And he knew all the areas along the coastline to bring things in. You know, he was amazing like that. He was kind of like an admiral. He had his own fleet of ships. He had seaplanes, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, he probably opened up a lot of those channels that those drugs were getting smuggled through, you know. So, you know, that was kind of one of the ways that Vito Genovese, when he came back, made it a little easier for him to kind of dispose of Frank because he was able to turn a lot of those guys down at the lower level against him. They saying, you know, he's telling us not to sell these drugs, but he's making all this money doing his own thing. And we're all down here, you know, starving, whatever. So he was really able to kind of turn the tide, a lot of those folks against Frank. And that's, you know,
now we all know what happened. Remind me of this timetable here during the war or right after the war. Vito Genovese and Lucky Luciano were in Italy or Sicily. I don't remember if they went clear to Sicily or not, but they were in Italy. And Vito came back. Lucky never got to come back. He tried to get close and went down to Cuba, and they ended up getting him kicked out of Cuba. But Vito came back eventually and then wanted to take over the Luciano family. And Luciano by that time was getting old enough that I guess he felt like he could get it done. So that was what was going on. He even, I think, didn't he try to kill Frank?
He did, yeah. I mean, there's so many stories out there. You know, again, it's I kind of look at my website and Frank's place as, you know, I don't say this is what happened. Yeah. It's like, here's you know, the five stories that I've heard about this, all of them different. You're going to have to make up your own mind on that. But one of the ones that I tend to kind of agree with is, when Vito came back, according to a lot of the books, he was kind of handed the family back. You know, Frank wasn't going to be the kind of guy who was like, well, no, this is mine now. Vito was the boss first before he left. And if he came back, Frank would have been the kind of guy that was like, okay, this is how it runs. He'd probably been happy to get out of the job and go back to playing golf and just doing his own thing without all the headache. But one of the problems was why Vito was gone. You know, Frank was pretty successful at bringing in big bucks with, you know, his casinos, all that kind of stuff.
And especially those slot machines all down through the South.
Oh, yeah.
He got hooked up down with Carlos Marcello down in
he did, yeah. I mean, he spread the family.
There's a ton of gambling machines out there, and there's a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. When you look at the time that Frank took over, I mean, he expanded that family greatly in the years that he was the boss. But when Vito came back, even if he was in the position of the boss, most of the rackets they were really making the money in were Frank's. So one way that he kind of looked at it was like, well, Frank's got all this stuff tied up. What am I going to do? And Vito wasn't going to be the kind of guy that's just going to sit up there and not be in charge of everything. You know, he'd have to be running stuff himself. So I think, you know, that's kind of where that started. He wanted to get Frank out of the way and take over his rackets, that kind of stuff. And then he would be the guy that was fully in charge. So I don't really think that, you know, when Vito came back, I think he really kind of was given that position back, but he wasn't comfortable with Frank still being around because too many people still came to him for problem solving and things like that. You know, Vito wanted them to come to him. So he tried to get him hit, but you know, depending on what you believe, there's another great legend out there that that he didn't even really want him dead. That was just supposed to be a warning shot, just to send a message. I don't believe that at all because I don't think there's anybody out there that could make that shot.
It's like the police. There is no warning shots. There are no warning shots. People say, "Oh, you wing them or you know, get a warning shot." There is no warning shots. There is no winging. Yeah. You either shoot somebody to kill them and go walk away, or it's an accident that you don't get them killed.
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, I don't know anybody that could make a shot where you could just graze somebody's scalp on the side and not really kill him, you know. And, I just think he missed. And Frank got the message. And Frank, again, was not the kind of the guy to go to war over something like that. He wasn't even really that interested in probably, you know, being the boss at that time. Like I said, he had so many legal headaches and different things like that going on at the time that, you know, if they were going to allow him to retire, he'd be fine. Just great. You take over. I got my own headaches right now. So I kind of, you know, I think that's what happened with that. Other people will tell you, no, you know, there's all sorts of reasons they think that it was set up. Like, you know, one of the reasons they say, why would you just send one person in to shoot a boss and a hit? But I'm like, they knew he didn't have a gun. They knew he was by himself. He didn't have bodyguards and stuff like that. So to me, I don't really think that's any kind of reason to think that it was just a warning shot. But yeah, in the end, you know, that was the Chin that supposedly shot him. And Chin is featured, you know, really heavily in this Godfather of Harlem show. He's Vincent D'Onofrio.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's great. I think he does, you know, they even
Vincent
have
Vincent the Chin Galante.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And a lot of people may not know that he was a up and comer at that point in time. He was a guy that in the end
or Gigante.
Gigante,
sorry,
yeah.
not Galante. That's the other guy.
The other guy. Yeah. The cigar guy.
Carmine, yeah, Lilo.
Yeah, okay, we get our mob guys mixed up here. But is he the same guy that in later years then walked around and acted like he was crazy when he was down in?
He did, yeah, he was. He was. Okay. And they have that in the show. Okay. They show him, you know, walking around in the bathrobe and all that stuff, being in the bathtub but other than that, you know, pretty much all the other stuff about the Chin in there is fictional too. They have him and Frank Costello constantly hanging out together, working together. And you know, supposedly, if you believe the story, in court when the Chin was in court for, you know, shooting Frank, Frank said he didn't recognize him, and the Chin got off. And they say that when the Chin was walking out, he said, "Thanks, Frank," and they shook hands. And there's even a report that they were seen having breakfast together at Frank's penthouse one time after this. So, but as far as being super close and friendly like they are in the show, I have a hard time believing, even if Frank is kind of known as a peacemaker, that he's going to want to spend too much time with the guy trying to shoot him in the head, you know? So, but it makes good drama in the show, for sure.
Casey, now, the Godfather of Harlem, then it starts about this point in time when actually Frank Costello is taking his retirement after he's been shot. And Vito Genovese is the boss of the old Luciano family, which will become the Genovese family. And the Chin is like advising him. They're like together. Is that what I'm hearing you saying?
Kind of like, well,
that's when it starts.
One of the things that, so I think it's right around 63 is when this is supposed to start. And at that time, you know, Vito would have been in prison. And in reality, you know, from what I've heard, I think that Fat Tony Salerno was really the guy that was running Harlem at that time. But in this show, they chose to go with the Chin. I read an interview with the writer, and he said that was just a choice because the Chin was such a colorful character. There's so many things you could do with him in a show like this. But at that point, really what you generally hear about Costello is he kind of became like an elder statesman advisor for everybody. He used to hang out at the Waldorf every day, and it was kind of like his office. People would just come to his table, sit down, and, you know, ask for money, advice, whatever they needed from him. And he liked that. I think he thought of himself as an advisor role. You know, he was a consigliere originally, and that's a role that he really took to. He liked being sought after for advice and that kind of stuff.
Tony, during that, when Sam Giancana was actually the out front boss, then Tony Accardo and Paul Rica, they set up at this one restaurant, a Mayo's restaurant in Northwood, I think, the north side of Chicago. And they'd sit up in that restaurant most every day. And people would come in and talk to them and seek their advice. And it's kind of like they were the boss of the boss in a way. And
right.
The same thing in Kansas City. Nick Civella was the out front guy who was on the streets and talking to people. But he wasn't the underboss. He had an underboss who actually would go out and take the real enforcement action and make sure everybody was towing the line and pick up money. But Nick Civella was you know, the known boss, but he had this Joe Filardo, who was a guy that introduced him at the, was going to introduce him at the Apalachin Convention in 1957 as a new boss of Kansas City. So that's not that uncommon, I think, to have that senior advisor that, you have the guy that everybody knows as the boss, but you have these people that seem to be retired and are back behind the scenes.
I've heard too that, you know, there's when Costello would, you know, set up court at the Waldorf up there at his table, some of those scenes in The Godfather, the wedding scene, there's the ones where, you know, Michael's, it has a line of people constantly coming to him looking for stuff. But a lot of that is kind of based off of Frank in that way that, you know, said if you could go up there at any afternoon and watch his table, and it was just a series of one after another, you know, guy would sit down, they'd do some business, the guy would get up, move, and then a guy from another table would just take his place, and that's where he did a lot of that business. So I think a lot of that kind of came from there. But you know, in the show, The Godfather of Harlem, I think that they bump up Frank's importance during those times in the 60s probably more than it was, though. They still in the show have all sorts of people coming to him for political favors to get them in political positions and things like that. And in reality, at that time, you know, he had been on TV and in the papers so much that it kind of ruined his reputation for being able to hang out with politicians and stuff. Yeah. And, you know, at that point, you know, they couldn't be seen with him like they could in the early days.
Yeah, the famous scene that was all over the newsreels of the day? He's talking about Mr. Costello, if he did anything good for society.
You paid my tax.
I paid my taxes. What more do you want, man? I paid my taxes.
Right? And you know that, you know, that was one of the first media spectacles that we ever had in this country, because TV was still pretty new and millions of people were watching him and seeing that. And so that was another way that Vito was kind of able to turn the tides against him. It was just like, look, you know, this guy, how effective can he be as a boss? Like, he can't go anywhere without, you know, 50 FBI guys following him. Everybody recognizes him now. He had people coming up just like Al Capone and Gotti would want his autograph. And so, I mean, that really severely limits your use in that world. And, you know, politicians at that point started to veer away from him. And he'd get kicked out of country clubs, stuff like that. He was constantly having to battle that kind of stuff after that. When he just wanted to be, you know, looked at as a businessman, but, you know, everybody knew at that time what he was. So I think that's pretty highly fictionalized in the show, like his importance, first of all, in the mob and also politically at that time. He was certainly still involved in certain things, and I think mostly he was good at, like, kind of helping settle disputes between guys. You know, people respected him. He was a calm head, and he could get people to come together in agreements and settle disputes. He was great at that kind of stuff. And I think that was more of kind of what he did. But from what I've heard, some of the people that I've talked to who have actually met him, the people that I've talked to who have met him, you know, met him pretty late in life, just because, you know, we're at that age now. But it sounds like he was still active right up to the end. He died when he was 82 in 1973. But he was healthy, walking the streets of New York, and still active. The last kind of conversation I've had with a guy who'd met him just months before he died, and they went to have lunch with him to settle a dispute with a union thing, and they thought Frank could help him out. And I was like, well, you know, he was still getting sought after for help right up to the end.
Interesting. I have a question about that period in his life, which is mainly what we're talking about. You know, when he was shot, didn't the police pull a piece of paper out of his pocket that showed the daily take from one of the Las Vegas casinos from the...
Yeah, your casino, the Tropicana.
And they matched up for that day or the day before. Those numbers were right, and which indicates he was getting something out of that. Or he had a big interest in money at the Tropicana.
Yeah.
So in that later part of his life, is your studies or your interviews, you learn anything about, was he continuing to get skim from out there or some kind of cash money? Because those guys are not going to send him a check like he's a shareholder or anything.
Right.
I got to save some cash money.
Well, I know that right after that, you don't really see any pictures of him in Vegas or anything like that, which I thought was kind of strange. I've always on the lookout to find one of him in one of the casinos there. And I know he certainly went there for a time or two, but after that, he was kind of blacklisted.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
you know how that works. So he really couldn't head out there anymore, but he certainly must have been getting some little bits of cash from here or there. After he was retired with Vito, I mean, Vito kind of took over his rackets and was getting the money. The one that I know he let Frank Costello keep was the Copacabana, because Frank was one of the guys who started that, and that was always kind of considered his club. And Vito let him keep that. So he was getting money from the Copa, which was always probably pretty profitable. And he had oil wells. He had a lot of legitimate businesses going on, and the Beverly down in New Orleans. So he was getting, money. I've heard at the end, it was starting to trickle out a little bit. He was friends with Generoso Pope, the guy who started the National Enquirer.
Oh, really?
And Frank was one of the ones who got that started. He gave him, like, I think it was $10,000 every month to his payroll to get everything going. And then soon as, the circulation would get Generoso the money back, he would pay Frank back off, and he did that for like probably 4 or 5 months until he had built up enough money on his own to just keep it going, and then he didn't. But there's one story that towards the end of his life, Frank kind of came to him and asked for a loan, and Generoso turned him down. He was going to give him some money, but not as much as Frank had asked for, and so Frank told him, just forget it. He's like, I put the guy in business, and now he just blows me off. So I think towards the end, with IRS stuff, he was probably starting to trickle down in the money. He was a huge gambler, and that probably played a lot into it. And from what I've heard, like Toots Shore and guys like that remember, hanging out with him there, so like, he gambled to get hurt. Like, he didn't just gamble a couple bucks here and there. He broke himself a couple times and then had to build it back up. So, I don't think that he stopped his gambling habits towards the end. I think he probably picked it up because he had more time to go do it.
Not unless he went to Gamblers Anonymous. He didn't stop that guy.
Yeah,
I don't think he did. He just like John Gotti. That was his big problem. He was trying to get more and more money from everybody under him because he had all these gambling debts. And he needed to pay them off to maintain his status. I mean,
his image and all that.
Gambling debt in that world, even if you're more powerful than the guy you owe it to, you just can't do that. And so,
yeah, Welshire is the worst thing you could be.
You got to be a stand-up guy. So,
yeah,
interesting.
But I know that once when he died, they sold his house and the penthouse, and his wife Bobby moved back down to New Orleans, where her family was kind of from. And but I think at that point the IRS kind of cleaned him out. There's a legend that he always kept a suitcase with $1 million in it for an emergency, which might have been true. He could have had cash stowed away, that she just used sparingly and didn't go out and get flashy with it. But from the relatives I've talked to that knew her and were in her apartment that she moved to and everything, it sounded like, most of the money went to the IRS after Frank passed. I think she was pretty lost. She didn't, he was the guy that was handling all that. She was just a 50s wife, She wasn't involved in much of that. And so you know, at the end, like a lot of these guys, they're like rock stars. They think the money's just going to always come in, and you get older and it stops. What are you going to do? You know,
they didn't have a 401k or a 403b.
No, he did not have a 401k.
A lot of those guys, they won't even pay into Social Security because they've always done these, you know, scams all their life, or you know, had a book and they not, you know, they just barely declare enough money to show what it looks like that they're making. So they don't even pay that much in Social Security. I suppose they pay in enough to get it, but
I mean, they say that he would carry his spending gambling cash in one pocket, and he would have lending cash in the other. And when people would come up to get a loan from him, he would always give them an extra $100 to see if they brought it to his attention. And if they didn't, he would never give them a loan again because he thought that he learned something about that person. True. And if they did bring it to his attention, then they were okay with him. But, you know, just like that envelope that he left, he used to walk around with just tons of cash. He was a strictly cash basis kind of guy, probably. So
I got a little cash stuck away over here, and I'm not telling you where, but it's my traffic ticket money. When I do a traffic ticket, usually people pay me in cash. So oh, the IRS just will be after me for now, won't they? Well, it's not that much money, but.
That's how I am with my music earnings. Money, you know, it's pretty much all in cash, and that just goes in my little jar so I can fly to Kansas City for Bob World Summit and stuff like that.
I'm working on that now. Okay, well, let's finish this off. I think are we pretty well done here? This is kind of during the time. You know, I think we've covered the Godfather of Harlem deal and his connection to it. And
I would just say watch the show if you get a chance, because, you know, he when you look at things like Boardwalk Empire and a lot of those shows, Frank Costello never ends up in those. I don't know why. It's always Bugsy, Lansky, and Lucky, you know? And for some reason, Frank Costello's just never really got into the movies like a lot of these other characters. So even though it's a completely fictional thing, it's really fun for me to just watch to see Frank in a role. And it's Paul Sorvino who is, you know, he's somebody to play Frank Costello that can be convincing as a boss. Yeah. And Paul Sorvino, he's perfect at it, I think. I really like the way he portrays Frank.
Yeah, really. You know, I did a show on Kill the Irishman with another guy that helps me out with stuff. He's one of my administrators for my web page or my Facebook page, Basil Terabisi from down in Texas. And we talked about Kill the Irishman, and Paul Sorvino was in that, and Vincent D'Onofrio was in that, too. So those guys, we were talking about that, how there's a small cadre of people out there that earn a pretty good living in these mob movies.
Yeah, I mean, I would just suspect at this point, somebody in Hollywood, we need a boss. We'll just call Paul Sorvino. You don't even need an audition. He just has that air about him. And when you look at pictures of Frank, you know, he has that air about him. He looks like a boss. You know, everybody, when he'd walk into a room, he just had that kind of thing about him that, you know, he was in charge. And so I've seen a couple portrayals of Frank and just little bit parts and stuff. And the guys that they have are kind of, I mean, it's like, it doesn't look anything like him. And they don't have the, you know, that panache or whatever you call it. I don't know. But so I think Sorvino was a good choice.
Really? All right. You know, one last thing. How did he get the name, the Prime Minister of the Underworld? Do you know? In your studies,
Well, there's a couple of stories about that. The one that usually comes up the most is during the Atlantic City Conference. You know, this was right after when they brought Capone in, because after the Valentine's Day massacre, that stuff. Yeah, they wanted to, you know, kind of set him down and say, hey, you need to cool it out a little bit. You're bringing too much heat. And they were also going to use that conference, you know, to kind of start bringing people together to form what was going to be that syndicate, you know, once they got rid of Masseria and all those guys. But so supposedly at the conference, even though at that time Frank was still – he wasn't as high ranking, but he sort of arranged that whole thing, and everybody was very impressed with him, the way he brought everybody together, you know, would introduce people to each other. And supposedly it was him that set Capone down and convinced him to go to jail on the gun charge to kind of take some of the heat off him. And after that, everybody kind of looked at him like, wow, you know, you're like like a prime minister. You're like a diplomat kind of guy, because that's what he excelled at. You know, he was good at that kind of stuff. You know, he didn't get that name like, you know, the Blade or the Lord High Executioner. It was more suiting for what who he was.
The clown.
So that's one of the stories. And again, you know, I'm not saying it's true. But this is just one of the things that you read. So
interesting.
That's what's out there.
All right, Casey, I appreciate it. And I know the wiretappers out there will appreciate this show on Frank Costello. He's a really interesting guy, and he was hugely important in the development of the modern-day National Crime Syndicate.
There's nobody like him. I mean, the one thing that's amazing about him is his run, it starts, you know, pre-prohibition in those early days of when the Italians kind of immigrated, all the way up into the 70s, and he was active during that whole time. So he went through prohibition, he went through the Castelmovese Roar, I can never say that word, but he wasn't just a participant either. I mean, he was one of the architects of all that stuff. He wasn't just passing through all those things. I mean, he helped start gambling. If you talk to Bill Freeman, you know, he'll tell you there's nobody in the history of American gaming that did more than Costello. And he just goes through all those fascinating times of the mob. And his career is just so long. There's just so much to talk about. And there's books. There's so many pictures of him.
Yeah.
There's audio of him talking, which is great. You know, so he's a fascinating guy. He's a good subject to get into because you can go for a long time before you run out of stuff.
Another interesting thing talking about Bill Freeman is he said that, you know, when Vegas legalized gambling and it started to become more and more popular, the ranchers and the local people out there didn't really know how to run a casino. They knew how to run businesses, but they didn't know how to run a casino. And who knew how to run a casino? But all these carpet joints and people had been overseeing the slot machines for people like Frank Costello all over the United States. And
so
those people then matriculated or moved out to Las Vegas and started getting the jobs to help run the casinos. And, you know, really those people are the ones that got Las Vegas going and made it successful.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it might have kind of collapsed in on itself. Somebody else could have legalized gambling, but it took off.
Yeah. They say that's how he got the nickname Uncle Frank, was when he started to move down to New Orleans with Marcello and all that. He sent most of his family to kind of run his legal, you know, businesses down there. And so most of the people that were working for him, they weren't made people. He was pretty strict about it. He didn't bring his family into that life kind of thing. But he did fill up his businesses with his family. And that was another thing that made some of the mob people mad. It's like he didn't give them those jobs. He gave his family members those jobs. So everybody that worked for him was kind of an underling relative, and so they all called him Uncle Frank, and that's how he got that name.
And what happens is we got a guy here in Kansas City that people will refer to him as Uncle Frank because he's got a book, I think, and he's got a bunch of different people in businesses who are related to him that call him in around the area, and they call him Uncle Frank, so everybody kind of starts calling him Uncle Frank. Nick Cavella, they called him Zio, which is was that uncle or is that grandpa? No, it's uncle.
I think it's uncle or something,
they
right?
They call him Zio. And so in the wiretaps and stuff, many times other people refer to him as Zio. It's not like it's a, you know, never really got out in the public because he was such a non-public guy. You're not going to find any images of Nick Cavella out there in the public other than,
the one with Bill leading him
into the
stairs.
Leon
that's about
Crossy
it.
And Shea Airy leading him in with his coat over his head. Yep. That's the greatest perp walk shot I have ever seen.
I love it. Yeah, I asked him when I interviewed him. I'm like, man, I hope you have that picture like in your living room on the wall or something. He's like, as a matter of fact, I do. But yeah, they say, Frank, he didn't like the Prime Minister nickname, but he did like the Uncle Frank nickname. He thought he liked that one.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Casey. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Gary. I'm glad to finally made it onto Gangland Wire.
It's been great. Let me finish this off now. If you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. You know, I got a website out there that's got a lot of got all the show notes on it. That's www.ganglandwire.com. I've got my new movie, Brothers Against Brothers, the Cavella-Spiro War. It's on Amazon Prime. You can rent it. If you go to the more purchase options, you can get it for $1.99. I shouldn't tell you that because most people get it for $2.99, the high definition version. I don't think there's any difference in the versions. because I get a piece of that action, a percentage. But Gangland Wire, that's there now. If you want to make a donation on my website or through Venmo or whatever, $25 or more, and I'll give you a copy of either Gangland Wire, the DVD, which has special features on it, or Brothers Against Brothers, which has some special features on it, or my book, or I'll send you a coupon for the Kindle version of my book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. You all know that that Kindle version has the actual wiretaps that I used in the book linked to it, so you can actually hear the wiretaps of the people who were involved in skimming from Vegas casinos. I got the Kansas City Mob Tour app. You can get that on the Apple Store and take your own personal mob tour of Kansas City. And so I appreciate all you wiretappers out there that have donated and supported this in many ways. I always supported a little more for free by just going to my Facebook page and liking it and then sharing stuff I put on there, because the bigger of a following that I get out there, then the more people will find my work. And that's what it's all about, isn't it, Casey, is getting your name out there.
It is. You got to make relationships, and people will help you out.
Right. You know? Like you and me, and me and Pam up in Chicago. You know, a big tip of the hat to Camulus Robinson in Chicago has been a huge help. I say this every time I have him on. And now I've got Basil Terabiche, who's been helping with the Facebook page. And so it's, you know, you can't do this all by yourself. I got to keep earning a living a little bit along too. So I appreciate everybody that's helped me. All right. Good night, Casey. Good night, folks.
All right. Thanks for having me, Gary.
All right.
Take care.
All right, Casey. That's been fun.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.